which way to go, according to what strategy. Peering east around the tree, I attempted to count them as they gathered by the fence. All in black, they were darker than the night, contrasted with it, but they milled around, making it difficult for me to tally them. There were at least six, maybe eight. Either number was too many, bad odds for me. We were in a kind of forest again, but one that was regimented, geometric, offering less cover than the wildwood. They could spread out more here, maintaining a longer search line, yet each man would still be within sight of those to either side of him. Not yet one flashlight. With night vision gear, they wouldn't be foiled by the density of the trees, as they had been among the cottonwoods. They would have clean lines of sight. If I raced along one of the open alleys, I would be quickly spotted. Even crossing an alley from one rank of trees to another, I would draw attention to myself, because from their perspective, I would be the only moving thing in the warm stillness of the almond grove. I had to stay to a single row of trees, close to the trunks, head down to avoid taking a low branch in the face or across my throat. And I had to get moving. They were already forming a line, getting ready to come into the grove on a north-south hunt. I set out to the south, keeping my single-row tactic. I moved fast, but not nearly at a sprint, not at first. This close to them, my pounding footfalls would locate me in seconds. I needed to put some distance between us before I could run flat out. Taking short, quick strides, almost gliding across the ground, I tried to recall how far it was to the southern end of the orchard. The grove was much longer from north to south than from east to west. Hundreds of acres. A mortal distance under the circumstances. Birds worried me. The possibility of another mass exodus from branches overhead. A flare of sound that would declare, "Here he is!" After I'd gone 30 yards or so, an owl loudly questioned the night. From elsewhere in the grove, another owl replied, and almost at once yet another. Every orchard attracted field mice and sometimes rats, depending on the crop, and owls considered rodents of any size to be delectable. Wherever owls stood night watch, other birds tended not to roost, because owls also had an appetite for their smaller feathered brethren. Moving quickly, light-footed, moving, anticipating shouts and gunfire, I tried to remember what I'd find at the end of the orchard. I couldn't recall a farmhouse or trailer. Not any kind of living quarters. The operation was owned by a large corporation, not a family, and as far as I knew, no one lived on the property at night. There was an immense processing building in which the green fruit of the trees would be stripped away from the pits and the smooth almond seeds from their hard, fibrous jackets. Maybe 3 or 4 additional structures. Garages for the harvesting equipment and other machinery. Product storage. Offices. If I could survive the orchard and get a few buildings between me and the posse, night vision goggles wouldn't be of as much use to them. When the search involved land around buildings, they couldn't hold to a rigid line. They would have to split up to some extent, and my options would multiply. There might be a security guard or two at night, not to patrol the orchard, but to prevent thieves from stealing valuable machinery and vehicles. Problematic. Not that a security guard might be rash enough to shoot me first and ask questions in the afterlife, but if the cultists on my trail would be so bold as to chop the explorer to pieces with automatic weapons fire, in an area where the noise could trigger calls to 911, they might answer a guard's challenge with bullets. I didn't want to be responsible for leading them to a victim. I hope the orchard buildings were protected only by good steel doors and state-of-the-art alarm systems. The owls, perhaps as many as half a dozen roosting across the length of the orchard, were hooting regularly to one another, their voices echoing eerily among the trees, as if they were urging me on, or cheering those who pursued me. The time had come to run full tilt, without regard to the noise I would make. Remaining close to the same row of trees, I bolted, taking longer strides, feet slamming against the ground, gasping for breath, making enough noises that I could now hear only the closest owl. I thought they couldn't run and fire their weapons at the same time, not effectively, not even if they caught sight of me. Afraid of losing me unless they matched my pace, they would have to forego shooting in order to stay close on my trail. Wrong. If they had Uzis or other fully automatic carbines, they could flick a switch from single fire to burst fire, which at least one of them did. The hard stutter of a machine gun rattled through the almond grove, no doubt chasing even the fearless owls from their perches. Full Metal Jacket rounds snapped into the trunks with terrible power, louder than a nail gun driving steel spikes into a 4x6, loud enough for me to hear those impacts separate from the gunfire. Dirt and pebbles sprayed across my shoulders and the back of my head, as a low round must have kicked the ground behind me. I dodged from one side of the road to the other, better using the trees for cover, slaloming among them, which increased the chances of being taken down by a branch harder than my head. A scream, loud, shrill, prolonged, as the gunfire abruptly ceased. I thought that maybe one of the searchers, hurrying forward too eagerly, had gotten ahead of the gunner and had taken a round or two. As the hideous screams seemed to slither through the grove with corporal substance, I stopped dodging around the trees and ran only along the west side of the row. My legs on fire, chest aching, each exhalation hot as furnace air. I couldn't keep up that pace much longer. I was no more a marathon runner than I was a man of action. I thought the need to tend to one of their own injured would bring a couple of them to a halt, improving my odds of survival. I saw a pale geometry in the darkness ahead, the white boards of the southern fence. If they were delaying 10 seconds, 20, I could be up the fence and over, at least temporarily out of sight. A shot rang out, and the screaming stopped. Another single shot, perhaps, made certain that the screamer had been permanently silenced. They weren't the type to leave a wounded comrade behind. They were the type who would finish him off and be done with the distraction. I shouldn't have expected anything else, considering that Jim and Bob executed Wolfgang, Jonathan, and Celine, merely because I might have seen their faces. True believers. Fanatics. They didn't fear death. In their view, death came with a reward. They probably thought they would be royalty in hell. The execution of their own had set them back no more than 5 seconds, if at all, but the fence loomed immediately in front of me. 38. I slammed into the fence, grappled for handholds, towed up from the base rail, went monkey-fast over the top, and fell to the ground on the farther side just as a hail of man-stoppers cracked the top rail and the crossboards. Bullet-plucked chicken wire twanged and plinked as I went flat and squirmed away. The land sloped down to a wall of boulders, stacked as they might be in a breakwater at the entrance to a harbor. I scrambled down them to a flash flood channel about 12 feet wide and at least 10 feet below the elevated orchard. Crane-placed boulders formed the farther wall as well. Maybe the cultists knew what lay beyond the fence, knew that I could stand upright and still be well below their line of fire. The guns fell silent again. In seconds, they would be climbing the fence. We didn't get a lot of rain in the Mojave, but from time to time we were hit by a storm of such power that everyone made lame jokes about building an ark. In town, a well-planned and extensive drainage system could handle all but the most intense, protracted downpours. But where there were no city streets and storm drains, the rushing torrents either created temporary lakes or race through the arroyos that have been carved in the land by centuries of such deluges. This was one such arroyo, fortified for the length of this property to protect the orchard and to prevent further erosion. If I went to the right, west, I'd eventually reach a 2-lane country road. There wouldn't be much traffic at that hour. Even if I could flag down a vehicle, I would be less likely to escape than to be shot along with whoever stopped to give me a ride. I hurried to the east, toward the array of buildings that serve the orchard. If you're running for your life, a drainage channel of that kind is no safer than a long hallway, which itself has much in common with a target lane and a shooting range. When my pursuers caught up with me, I wouldn't have anywhere to hide, because the sloped walls of boulders weren't as nature might have tumbled them, but were instead stacked tightly and with calculation to ensure stability. Far away in the night, a siren wailed. It didn't give me any hope, The police might have been responding to 911 calls related to the barrage that destroyed the Explorer, but they surely weren't already aware of events at the orchard. Delaying a few seconds longer than seemed wise, I finally darted to my right and scrambled up the mass of rocks. Maybe the assassins' weapons, which were more cumbersome than pistols, and whatever other gear they might be carrying, slowed them down a little when they had to scale the fence. Or maybe they needed a few seconds to spot me after they reached the channel. Whatever the reason, I made it to the top of the boulders and started toward the nearest building before gunfire rattled again. One brief burst. The keening of a few spent rounds ricocheting off stone. The subsequent silence suggested that I must have gotten ahead of them to an extent that persuaded them not to waste ammunition. Here, the ground was heavily graveled to keep down workday dust, and it crunched underfoot as I approached the first building, which appeared barn-like but massive. Perhaps 200 feet long and 60 wide, 2 stories, small windows high on the long wall, maybe 30 of them in a row, a few feet under the eave of the curved roof. All were dark. The narrow end of the structure featured 2 large roll-up doors and a man door between them. Above each truck-size entrance, a security lamp poured forth a pool of light, and a camera gazed down from higher still. I feared being an easy target in that brightness, but I didn't want to waste time running wide of it. I sprinted onto that well-lit stage and hoped that we had not arrived at the death scene. Past the first big door, past the second, turned right at the corner. For the next several seconds, they would not have me in sight, with or without night vision goggles. 20 or 25 yards beyond the first building stood 3 others, smaller but still large, each a different size, a different shape. This one wood, that one concrete block skinned with stucco. I ventured among them, putting more walls between me and the cultists. The security lights here were dim or regular bulbs, not floodlights like the first two. Shadows were plentiful. Gravel had been spread in a thinner layer here than elsewhere, but silent movement remained impossible. On the upside, I couldn't leave footprints in a carpet of small loose stones. I'd had about enough of running, whether under fire or not. The air temperature was 75 degrees or a little higher. I was sweating like you would think a pig would sweat. Actually, however, pigs don't sweat, another fact I learned from Ozzie Boone, who wrote a novel in which an expert on hogs trained 3 of them to kill an enemy of his. Anyway, my mouth was dry, throat scratchy, eyes burning from sweat salt. I needed to get out of the chase, find a hidey hole. Acutely aware that I had mere seconds to disappear from sight before the search team streamed among the buildings, rejecting one possible hiding place after another, I came to the back of the 2-story block and stucco building. Ladder rungs embedded in the wall led to the flat roof. I almost didn't see them in the dim light from a cage security lamp at the farther end of the structure. They were painted to match the stucco. When you think of hiding places, you imagine crawling under something, or behind something, or into a hole, but you can be easily trapped in such places. I could be trapped on a roof, too, but they would not be able to get me in their sights if I stayed below the parapet wall, and the only way to get to me would be by the ladder. Any fool who climbed it, even mildly suspicious that I might have taken refuge up there, would lose the top of his head when he came into view. I climbed quickly. The parapet wall, encircling the flat roof, was about 3 feet high, maybe higher. On my hands and knees, I crawled across the 40-foot-wide roof, intending to take a position directly opposite the ladder. Halfway across the roof, I realized my mistake. 40 feet would be too far from the ladder. In spite of my aversion to guns, I had learned to use them, but I was not a skilled sniper, and the Glock wouldn't be as reliable at 40 feet as it would be from a distance of, say, 6 inches. As I crawled back the way that I'd come, I heard the rattle and crunch of footsteps on gravel. I kept moving, making a lot less noise than the hunters were. Sitting with my back pressed to the parapet wall, immediately to the right of the ladder, I drew the Glock. As dark as it was on the roof, I could nevertheless see the pale white stucco of the parapet, the clean sweep of it. If I'd been sitting directly opposite the ladder, I would have been spotted the instant the climber's eyes cleared the top. I would have been the only dark shape silhouetted against the stucco, except for a few low vent stacks. On the ground, the cultists didn't like the gravel. Moving among the buildings, they tried to place their feet cautiously, but the loose stones defeated them. After taking several careful steps, each of them made the same decision, to bowl forward, clattering through the pebbles without regard to the noise, evidently convinced that too much caution was more dangerous than advancing boldly. The distant siren had faded to silence. Either the patrol car had been responding to a call about the shooting at the Explorer, or to something else altogether that had nothing to do with me and the posse on my trail. As I waited for the sound of feet on the ladder rungs, I tried to figure out how these people kept finding me. After the events in Nevada, they had revenge on their minds. They were using all their considerable resources, all their corrupt contacts, and everything from the political establishment to law enforcement to get their hands on me. If they'd known about the beach cottage where I'd been living for a couple of months, they would have tried to kill me there. They knew about the big dog bulldog bagger, but apparently didn't know that it had been garaged at the cottage. With my left hand, through my t-shirt, I felt the tiny silver bell at the end of the chain. I pulled it out from under the t-shirt and held it between thumb and forefinger. My racing heart slowed, and my fear diminished. If my enemy with a million eyes remained blind to the cottage, if they were unable to locate it, their failure had something to do with Anna Maria. The more I thought about it, the more it seemed as though I was not only safe from them, but also invisible to them while in Anna Maria's company. Almost from the day I met her, I'd known that she was more than she appeared to be, that the eccentric things she often said would in fact prove to be the plainest truth, if only I knew who and what she was and could consider her words in the context of her identity. I remembered what Mrs. Fisher said. "For all you may think differently, I'm only human. Anna Maria's human, too, though she's more than that, as you no doubt suspect. Human, but more than human. And with curious powers that, if fully known, would probably make my paranormal abilities seem pathetic by comparison." Below, the searchers were still crunching through the gravel, but not with as much enthusiasm. Not as many of them, either. From over near the largest building, the one I'd first come upon, I heard voices, but I couldn't make out the words. I turned the miniature bell back and forth between thumb and forefinger, pleased by the smoothness of it. It remained pleasantly cool. Neither the warm night, nor my body heat, nor the friction of my fingers rubbing the smooth, smooth silver could steal the coolness from it. Okay, the big dog motorcycle. I'd known since March, since Nevada, that sooner or later I would be returning to Pico Mundo, that the cultists had plans for my hometown. I knew as well I must make the trip alone. This threat was mine to thwart, or fail to thwart. My fate, whether or not the promise of the fortune teller's card would be kept, depended on my success or failure. Mrs. Fisher insisted on buying a car for me, but I worried that Tim and Anna Maria would be determined to make the trip with me if I had a car. I would not put them so directly at risk. Furthermore, Blossom Rosedale had sold her house in Magic Beach and had been intending to join us as soon as her affairs there were concluded. I couldn't put her in jeopardy either. Finally, and most important, I didn't want to rely on whatever protection Anna Maria's immediate presence might afford me. This battle was mine, to win or lose, by my best efforts, by my choices, by the right or wrong exercise of my free will. And so Mrs. Fisher had bought for me instead the big dog bike. The cultists found me as I'd driven home to Pico Mundo, found me more than once thereafter. And not all their success in that regard could be attributed to reverse psychic magnetism. If you believe the condition of humanity to be what they believed it to be, then their patron was the prince of this world, and at least some of his dark power was theirs to draw upon. The quest to find and kill a fry cook with a few marginal psychic talons that he couldn't fully control might not be a war to them. Might be instead a pleasant game. For all of Mrs. Fisher's wealth and cleverness and loyal friends and courage, she and I might be hopelessly outmatched by the cult. Two floors below, the sound of gravel scattering underfoot had ceased. I listened, wondering if they'd gone or were only standing still, waiting for me to emerge from hiding. The voices over by the main building had fallen silent a couple minutes earlier. Although I continued to rub it, the bell remained cool, cool and smooth. I was still sheathed in sweat, dripping, except for the thumb and forefinger on my left hand, which were perfectly dry as they held the tiny silver bell. I strained to hear the stealthy tread of shoes on ladder rungs. Nothing. There was no climber. No one could ascend that ladder in absolute silence. I felt the night moving like a sea towards some shore, a great wave of darkness swelling under me, a tsunami under Pico Mundo, under Maravilla County, rising toward a terrible height from which it would fall upon us, smash us, and sweep us away. And not just the town and county, but the state, too, and the country. The feeling grew so strong that I was tempted to rise to my feet and survey the land in all directions, as if the darkness itself might in fact have acquired real mass and the power to wash destruction across a continent. Just then, the largest building in the orchard complex was torn by a massive explosion. 39. The blast rocked the ground. The building under me shuddered, and I nearly bit my tongue as my teeth clacked together. The flash left my eyes less adapted to the dark than they had been an instant earlier. Louder than any crack of thunder that I'd ever heard, the detonation rolled away through the orchard, but in the aftermath a solemn tolling continued in my ears, as if I were not atop a two-story building, but were inside the bell tower of a cathedral. A sudden downpour clattered onto the roof. Not rain, debris, splinters of wood, slabs of wood as long as my arm, dirt and gravel, scraps of metal, twisted and hot and smoking. I closed my eyes and averted my face and covered my head with both arms until the stuff stopped peppering me. Torn and burning, the massive edifice, the almond processing plant, groaned as if it were a living leviathan, groaned and torqued out of true. At the sight of that structural torment, a woman below let out a wild rebel yell of exultation, her voice shrill with glee. Another cultist answered her, a second, a third, a fourth. The curved metal roof of the tortured structure bulged and buckled, rivets popping like corn, welded joints shrieking as they separated, widths of sheet metal peeling up to claw like robot hands at the night sky, where the low clouds reflected the sudden rush of fire. 200 feet away, at the farther end of the same building, a second explosion equaled the first. Because it was more distant, the flash seemed less bright. The bang split the night with cleaver-sharp sound. Although the stucco building quaked less violently under me than before, the effect on the processing plant was greater than that of the first explosion. Lit by fire, the immense structure rippled from the farther end to the nearer, as if I were not looking at it directly, but were seeing its reflection in the surface of a breeze-ruffled lake. Wood rafters and joists and studs cracked like the whips of the gods. Structural metal squealed as it was deformed by the initial shockwave, and what window glass had not shattered in the first blast shattered now. The behavior of the cultists, when they shot the explorer to pieces, and when they opened fire on me in the almond orchard, had been reckless. But this was insanity. They'd not come here with the intention of blowing up that building. They'd come here only because they were chasing me. The doors were locked, the windows high. I couldn't be hiding inside the place. The destruction of the processing plant seemed to be a pointless crime of opportunity. Worse, it seemed to have been done on a whim. They probably thought that I'd gotten away clean, and they were frustrated, disappointed, badly in need of a mood boost. Nothing could elevate your spirits more than blowing the crap out of a large building, a point of view that half the lunatics in the world would enthusiastically endorse. If, when you asked their opinion, they weren't busy beheading people. I figured we could be certain now that the ton of C4 hadn't been hijacked by some other group of maniacs, that these apostles of the demon Meridian were indeed the culprits. The amount detonated in this instance was at most a few pounds, which left them with more than enough to break the Malo Suerte Dam, if that happened to be their intention. But maybe C4 was the least of it. But if they did intend some epic act of evil, destruction on a scale so enormous that it would assure this night a place in the history books, wasn't it stupid to waste their time and risk compromising their main objective by blowing up a nut processing plant in an almond orchard? Just because I'd given them the slip and they were miffed? They were probably fist-pumping when they let out those rebel yells, maybe doing an end-zone dance of triumph. They appeared to be spiraling out of control. The discipline that had marked their scheming in the past seemed to be dissolving. Great tongues of flame seethed from the roof of the stricken building, licked through every crack in its walls, spewed out of the small high windows. Huddled against the parapet, I was at most 80 or 90 feet from the blaze. The heat began to wring more sweat from me than had the long run through the cottonwoods and the almond grove. Smoke, thus far churning into the night sky, suddenly rushed in thick gray masses from the side of the structure and plumed toward me as a portion of the wall collapsed. I couldn't stay on the roof. If smoke inhalation didn't kill me, it would cause fits of coughing, which would locate me for the cultists. If they didn't want to brave the climb and come after me, they could just wait for me to suffocate. Or they could blow this place up with me atop it. In fact, maybe they'd already placed more packages of C4. Maybe they were going to destroy every building at the orchard. I rose, turned to the ladder, and looked down, pretty sure that I would see a grinning face and a gun muzzle. No one waited below. Although some shadows danced here and there, the graveled ground between this building and the other two was largely well revealed by throbbing reflections of firelight. I hoped that the cultists were either gathered elsewhere to watch the fiery spectacle or had gone away altogether. Holstering the Glock, I swung onto the ladder and started down, just as a tide of smoke washed across the roof. Even though I was under the worst of the fumes for the moment, the air smelled wicked, a bath of toxic chemicals. At the bottom of the ladder, I drew the pistol, surveyed my surroundings, saw no one. Holding my breath, I ran toward the last two buildings, toward the space between them. No one would hear footsteps in the gravel above the roar of the flames and the thousand sounds of distress issuing from the doomed building. As big as silver dollars, ashes like enormous gray snowflakes spiraled to the ground around me. A storm of burning embers rained down too, carried by thermal currents from the ferocious blaze, dropping out as the currents weakened with distance. Each ember was a potential new fire, if by chance it fell upon fuel. I winced as one of them glanced off my face, shook another off my jacket sleeve, and brushed yet another out of my hair, blistering my left thumb in the process. Behind the last two buildings, at the east end of the complex, the gravel gave way to bare earth. Here, the night lay in deeper darkness than the territory I'd just left, although still somewhat revealed by firelight. I could see just well enough to discern a series of large troughs, maybe 12 feet long, 6 feet wide, 4 deep, elevated on concrete pads, each with a swan neck spout and a spigot at one end. I couldn't imagine a purpose for them, but they looked as if they were public baths for a race of giants. Beyond the troughs and the board and wire fence lay 20 feet of bare ground, and then, to the east, a shadowy vista of chaparral. On a warm evening like this, it was the kind of land that teemed with nightlife, though not the kind that required a dance band and adult beverages. Tarantulas, as big as my fist, lizards and rabbits that wouldn't hurt you, rattlesnakes that would, coyotes, a bobcat or three. I needed to get back to the fairgrounds. I still believed that the cultists had some intention there, other than to use the Somber Brothers Carnival as their cover and headquarters for this operation. As something inside the burning building exploded, and shrapnel banged and thudded off all manner of surfaces in the conflagration, I headed south, using the line of troughs for cover until there were no more of them. Low and bent-backed. Hurrying, but not running. I hastened into a secondary orchard, much smaller than the first. The heat of the fire and the flurries of ashes and smoke were far behind me. In the distance I heard sirens once more. Sirens combined with stentorian horn blasts that identified the vehicles as fire engines. As before, I stayed close to one row of trees, pausing at the 6th, the 12th, the 18th, to scope the orchard ahead and keep my breathing as slow and quiet as possible. I was too far from the burning building for the racket of its piecemeal collapse to provide much cover now. I resisted the temptation to glance back at the blaze. My eyes were not yet fully dark adapted again, and I needed them to adjust to the gloom as quickly as possible. Although lacking headstones and monuments, the orchard at night reminded me of a graveyard, perhaps because of the regimented rows, perhaps because I believed that black-clad figures, as faceless as death, would at any moment step out of cover and loom before me. At the 24th tree, 6 from the end of the orchard, I stood with my back to the trunk, held my breath, listened. I thought I heard a voice. 2 voices. I drew a breath or two, listened again, but heard nothing except a tree rat or a raccoon scratching its way along a branch overhead. Then the voices again. They were speaking low, but they weren't as quiet as they should have been if they were cultists on the lookout for me. I needed to locate them. In as low a crouch as I could get, without proceeding in a duck walk, I moved from the 24th tree to the 25th, leaning to the left, to the right, trying to tune in to the conversation. They fell silent. Back pressed to the almond tree, I waited, hoping that they hadn't gone quiet because they'd seen or heard me. My eyes were well adjusted to the dark again, which meant only that now I was merely half-blind. If money could buy anything, I would have called Mrs. Fisher and asked her to buy off the cloud cover and bring back the moon. Judging by the tone of their voices, when they spoke again, the unseen men were irritated. I eased forward to the 26th tree, to the 27th. Halfway to the 28th, I saw them, on the right. 2 figures dressed in black. Ahead of me at the end of the alley between this row and the next. So close. They evidently were supposed to be scanning the 10 feet of open ground that separated the almond trees from the fence that marked the southern perimeter of Maravilla Valley Orchards. They didn't seem to be deeply committed to the task. I kept moving, afraid one of them would look toward me at any moment. I put my back to the 28th tree, 2 from the end, and found that I was now close enough to hear what they said. "Damn it, Emery, that freak never come this way." "Yeah," Emery said, "but this is where they want us." "You'd break your own neck trying to kiss your own ass if one of the inner circle said so." "I'm not afraid of the inner circle." "Hell, you ain't." "Come on. I want to be where the action is." "Me too, Carl. Who doesn't?" "Well," Carl said, "it ain't here." Emery didn't respond. 5 or 6 minutes till maybe they blow that church." "They'll blow whatever they find. If it's the church, I gotta see it." "You don't care about that church." "Don't tell me what I don't care about." Emery said, "It's the farmhouse that has you hot." "You too. You seen the pictures. Them 2 girls, their mother. They aren't for us anyway, but we can watch it being done." "I've already seen it done, lots of times." "This is bullshit, man." "We don't want to get in trouble." "All we do want is trouble. You know what I mean. Yeah, you're a chicken shit." Emery didn't reply. Frustrated, Carl said, "Ain't we anarchists?" "It's pronounced an-ar-kists. And no, we aren't." I thought we was. We rule through chaos. That's different. Carl sounded like a pouting child. We need to be doing some anarchism. Intellectual arguments between Satanists were less witty than I had expected. You hear them sirens? Carl asked. Of course I hear them. Fire trucks. And cops close behind. Shouldn't be here for the cops, Emery said. Finally you said a smart thing. It's maybe 10 minutes before the farmhouse. So let's go. Let's get in the action. All right. You're right. Bet your ass I'm right. I heard footsteps, the rustle of clothing. Looking past the tree behind which I sheltered, I saw them moving away toward the fence. Prudence suggested that I should let them go. There were two of them, and they were heavily armed. The element of surprise might not be sufficient to get me into a confrontation and out the other side alive. This was the night of nights, however, and too much prudence might result in the forfeiture of the game. 40. I stepped away from the line of trees that I'd been following, into the alley between this row and the next, directly behind Emery and Carl as they approached the fence. One of them had some kind of combat rifle strapped slung over his shoulder. The other, carrying a rifle of his own, shouldered it too as they drew near the fence. My stomach seemed as if it were full of cocoons from which a flock of butterflies were emerging with still wet wings. The fluttery feeling of nervous anticipation combined with nausea. I moved with them, wanting a point-blank situation. They didn't hear anything. I was so close they should have smelled me. With a Glock in a two-hand grip, arms thrust forward, taking an isosceles stance, I waited until the first man started to climb before I said, "Freeze." They froze, for a moment anyway, and then the guy with 2 feet on the ground started to pivot, sliding the rifle off his shoulder as he turned, and I saw that he was indeed wearing goggles as I shot him twice. At the crack of the pistol, the guy on the fence looked in my direction, and after the second shot, as his companion dropped, I said, "I only want information." In his black clothes and ski mask and goggles, he looked like an extraterrestrial geared up for Earth's hostile atmosphere. "Information," I repeated. "Don't want to have to kill you." "Shit, you don't." He turned away from me, clinging to the fence. "What farmhouse?" I asked. "What's happening there?" The fool went for it, tried for the top of the fence, because he could not unsling the rifle in his position and would rather die than tell me about their intentions with the dam or anything else. I couldn't let him get away. I shot him in the back. It didn't feel like the worst thing I'd ever had to do, but it felt like one of the worst, and equal to many others. He fell off the fence, onto his back, not dead yet, gazing up at me through his goggles as I stepped forward and stood over him. Between clenched teeth, a thick, guttural expression of pain escaped him, as if he didn't want to give me the satisfaction of hearing him suffer. There was no satisfaction in it for me. "Just tell me what's going to happen tonight. What's all this about?" My solid-state digital watch didn't tick, and yet I heard it ticking. Instead, he told me to perform a sexual act with myself that no one with basic understanding of human anatomy would have believed possible. He was no longer able to bite off his pain. A squeal of agony escaped him. I shot him in the head and put an end to it. Closing my eyes, shuddering, I asked for a sign that what I had done was necessary, just one small sign. Nothing big. One small but incontestable sign. I opened my eyes. There was no sign. It doesn't work that way, and never did. I knelt beside the first dead man and removed his goggles. A rubber-sheathed wire connected them to a power pack clipped to his utility belt. I hooked the pack to my belt and put on the goggles. The night glowed green. There was darkness in the green night, plenty of it, but not as much as before this vision assist. Getting used to the eerie color and distorted perceptions arising from it would take a few minutes. The sirens weren't distant anymore. The fire trucks sounded as if they were near the orchard, perhaps already turning off the county road. Police might be following close in the wake of the trucks. The firemen and cops would know within 2 minutes that the explosions hadn't been related to gas line problems or to any other accidental causes. The blast evidence could be easily read. Chief Porter would ask the State Highway Patrol to lend some manpower. Soon this usually quiet rural area of Pico Mundo would be swarming with police, perhaps some of them manning roadblocks. Not all of them would be officers who knew me and would vouch for me. From the man who failed to climb the fence, I took a centerfire combat rifle. I had never used any weapon like it. I'd been raised by a mother who was mentally ill, but never institutionalized. She pretended to have suicidal tendencies, though she used her pistol only to intimidate her child. As a consequence, I disliked guns, but I learned to use them. I'd come to understand guns, that they were tools, and that they were no more evil, in their essence, than pliers and wrenches. At times, they were a necessity. In a world of evil, they were often also a blessing. Now and then, as I've said, I was able to fight off a thug with my encyclopedia of unconventional weapons, such as a clarinet, an oboe, and a trombone, a confrontation in a musical instrument shop, 3 buckets full of pig slops, not in a musical instrument shop, a wet mop, coconuts, wasp spray, and once, in fact, with a 12-volume encyclopedia. But often, firearms saved my life and the lives of others who depended on me. From personal experience in the orchard, I knew that these fully automatic rifles, as illegal as briefcase nukes, were capable of firing a single round or a deadly burst of bullets. I didn't know how this one was set or how to change the way it was set. I assumed it was still on fully automatic fire. These lunatics were unlikely to practice gun safety. From the dead man's utility belt hung 4 spare magazines. They appeared to hold perhaps 30 rounds each. On the rifle, I found the release button and ejected the current magazine, slapped a full one in its place. I found the bolt catch, made sure the bolt was not locked. I recognized the trigger. That was the extent of my knowledge of this kind of weapon. It was going to be a learn-as-you-go event. I took a spare magazine from the dead man, put it in an inside sport coat pocket, tearing the lining in the process. Mr. Bullock would never lend me another garment. I put a 2nd spare magazine in an exterior pocket. With the rifle slung over my shoulder, I went up and over the fence. How ironic it would have been if someone had shot me in the back as I climbed. In my mind's ear, I heard Emery and Carl. 5 or 6 minutes till maybe they blow that church. They'll blow whatever they find. The next explosion would be only 2 or 3 minutes away now, not 5. I didn't know which church and had no time to go looking for one. Although math had never been my strongest subject, I could put 2 and 2 together. The crew that pursued me through the orchard might or might not be the only one at work this night. They weren't using all the C4 to break the dam. They didn't need all of it for that. They were blowing up anything they encountered. Ain't we anarchists? It's pronounced anarchists, and no, we aren't. I thought we was. We rule through chaos. That's different. The behavior of these cultists wasn't as insane as I'd first thought. They had a strategy and tactics to support it. The almond processing plant and the church were distractions. Whatever else they blew up in the next hour would also be meant to distract the police, overwhelm them, and leave them with insufficient resources to deal with the true threat when it came. I needed to call Chief Porter, but I didn't have time just then. I thought I knew where the farmhouse was, the identity of the woman and her 2 daughters who were in imminent peril. With all the chaos erupting, the police would never get there in time. It's the farmhouse that has you hot. You too, you seen the pictures. Them 2 girls, their mother. They aren't for us anyway, but we can watch it being done. I've already seen it done lots of times. In the midst of sowing chaos, and before the main event of the night, the cultists were intending to take time for a quick religious ceremony. They were going to make an offering to ensure that the prince of this world, his satanic majesty, would look with approval upon the catastrophe that they hoped to bring down upon my beloved Pico Mundo. 3 human sacrifices. Beyond the orchard fence lay a much-patched, single-lane blacktop driveway, dating back decades, cracked and crumbling at the edges, tufts of grass and withered weeds growing through it in places, overhung by California live oaks as old as any trees in Maravilla County. This picturesque lane connected the nearby county road to Blue Sky Ranch, a place with a great deal of history, both triumphant and tragic. I turned at once eastward, into the green night, away from the county road, and I ran for my life, as well as for the lives of the mother and her 2 daughters who lived on the ranch. If Emery and Carl had their facts straight, I no longer had 10 minutes, maybe 7, or 6. Not even half a minute after coming off the fence and setting out for Blue Sky Ranch, I halted when it sounded as though God, in disgust, had slammed his big door on the world. I felt the explosion tremble the ground underfoot, and scores of dead leaves rattled down through the live oaks, falling upon me and around me, as if death himself, in a mood to mock, were sprinkling me with his equivalent of the holy water that a priest shook upon the faithful from an aspergillum. I pivoted, searching the night, stepped between 2 of the live oaks on the south side of the lane. The brightness overwhelmed my goggles, and I slipped them up onto my forehead. Perhaps a mile away, to the southwest, 100 or even 200-foot tower of fire cast off gouts of flaming debris that showered down the night like fireworks out of season. No church would burn that fiercely, that fast. They had blown up something else. Later I would learn that it was the County Highway Department's fuel depot, to which bulk gasoline was periodically delivered for the fueling of all county and municipal-owned vehicles. A packet of C4 with a timer had been lowered on a wire into the underground storage tank. With the blast, hundreds of gallons of burning gasoline had been at once spewed high into the night, and thousands of gallons remaining in the ruptured tank had been set ablaze. Even as I stood awestruck by the cultists' boldness and by the terrible scope of the destruction they had committed, and must intend yet to commit, another explosion slammed the night. Nearer than the first blast, perhaps a quarter mile this side of the raging gasoline fire, a fierce flash of white light was at once followed by an oak-shaking bang and an echoing roar, as if Thor, Scandinavian god of thunder and rain, wielding his hammer, Mjolnir, had smote the vault of heaven. I imagined that some church had just been reduced to rubble. Nearly 2 years earlier, before the mass murder at the Green Moon Mall, the Lesser Coven, that quartet of maniacs led by Officer Byrne Eccles and Simon Varner, had distracted me and had fogged my understanding of what was soon to happen. Had they not planted a corpse in my apartment and shot Chief Porter the night before that massacre, I might have put the pieces together more quickly, might have gotten to the mall 5 minutes sooner. Now I have the sense, yet again, that although these more ambitious cultists had failed to kill me in the Cottonwood Grove and in the orchard, they had nonetheless put me on the run and distracted me, so that when they pulled the trigger on their main event, I would be crucial minutes late, as before. I didn't wait to see the more modest flames that would build now in the wake of the blast. Turning east again, pulling the goggles over my eyes, I sprinted toward Blue Sky Ranch. 41. To the right of the driveway were acres of meadows, secured by ranch fencing infilled with fine wire mesh. The same aquifer that made possible the almond orchard provided sweetgrass and clover for the breed-worthy horses that, during the day, could sometimes be seen grazing there. Blue Sky Ranch had been for 2 generations one of the 3 or 4 most successful quarter-horse breeding operations anywhere in California and the Southwest. As a secondary business, they bred and trained horses for sulky racing. Bing Torbold and his wife had built the ranch and the business. His son, Bing Jr., upheld the family traditions and brought even greater glory to the storied Torbold stables. When Bing Jr. fell ill and his son, Carter Torbold, took over a decade sooner than anticipated, the slide to bankruptcy began. Carter gambled, not on horses, in Vegas. The casinos called his kind whales because of their fat bankrolls. Carter loved to gamble, but he had neither the discipline of a professional poker player nor any luck at all. The valuable breeding stock was sold off to an operation in Arizona. Without the legendary Torbold horses to breed new champions, the property and buildings were worth less than they might have been had the bloodline been still an asset of the ranch. 14 years ago, when they were 25, Dave and Lauren Ainsworth had bought the ranch at a distressed price. They had modest capital, a deep knowledge of horses, and a willingness to work hard, and the wisdom to know that delayed gratification was often the secret to success. In 10 years, they built a business and a winning bloodline that Bing Torbold would have admired. Then Dave got cancer and was gone in 6 months. Lauren had been running the place ever since, doing the work of two and raising her twins, Veronica and Victoria, by all accounts succeeding at both tasks. She and Dave had brought the girls to the Pico Mundo Grill occasionally, and often they had sat at the counter to watch me perform with spatulas, whisk, pot fork, and draining spoon, which could be an entertaining juggling act, especially if I hammed it up for the kids. As the driveway turned to the right, the residence came into view, a two-story Kentucky-style manor house, white with black trim. The place was smaller than it appeared to be because the generous veranda that wrapped three sides created the illusion of grandness. Most of the windows were bright, and the veranda lamps were aglow. The goggles magnified the light into a consuming green flare, and I pushed them onto my forehead again. I glanced at the luminous dial of my watch. How long? 5 minutes? 4? Maybe just 3? Lauren was standing in the side yard with her daughters, gazing west toward the colossal flames surging from the gasoline storage tank and the less dramatic fire at possibly a distant church. Their yellow Labrador retriever, Muggs, stood with them, alert. I called to them and identified myself as I hurried off the driveway onto the front lawn. The girls, almost 12 years old and marked by the easy ardency of that age, squealed with excitement and ran toward me, and Muggs came galloping after them. They hadn't seen me in nearly 2 years, but the events of this night so astonished them and inflamed their imagination that the suddenness of my arrival seemed ordinary by comparison. "Mr. Thomas! What are all the fires? Mr. Thomas, did you hear the booms? They were crazy loud. We were watching TV. The whole house shook. Boom, boom. Muggs went Scooby-Doo on us. He hid under the kitchen table." Muggs wove among us, his tail beating against our legs, panting and grinning, having overcome his terror, now filled with the girls' enthusiasm. They were lovely girls, with their mother's blonde hair and their father's gray eyes. They would turn heads when they were grown, just as their mother had turned heads, and still did. Lauren joined us near the veranda where it cornered from the front yard to the side yard. She had none of the girls' giddiness, and she shushed them. She was serious, and when she saw the combat rifle that I carried and then met my eyes, anxiety took possession of her face. "Trust me," I said. "Of course." "You have a gun?" "A pistol." "Get it. Fast. Take the girls to the stables. Hide there." She sprinted for the porch steps. I called after her, "Leave all the house lights on." Veronica and Victoria remained with me. They were still excited, but now also anxious. "What's wrong, Mr. Thomas? What's happening? Are we going to be okay?" "You'll be fine," I said. "Does Muggs bark much?" Veronica said, "He hardly ever barks." "He grumbles sometimes," Victoria said. "Sometimes he farts loud." "Hardly ever," Veronica said. "But when he does, it's a window rattler." "In the stable," I warned them. "Make sure he doesn't bark." Veronica held the agitated dog by the collar. Both girls looked toward the fires, and Victoria said, "Is someone going to bomb us?" I'm not sure how I knew which of them was Veronica, which Victoria, but I knew. No one's gonna bomb you, but you need to be brave. We can be, Veronica said. We have been, Victoria said. Veronica said, we had to be, since we lost Daddy. Their mother hurried out of the house, closed the door behind her, and descended the porch steps. She carried a pistol and a flashlight. I said, hide as best you can, then don't use the flashlight until I come for you. All right. I thought I heard, faintly, an approaching engine. When I glanced back at the colonnades of oaks that canopied the driveway, I saw no telltale headlights. Nevertheless, I said, go! 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 The three of them and the Labrador hurried past the house, east toward the stables and the training track. Trusting Lauren to follow my instructions, I retreated from the well-lighted house to the darkness along the perimeter of the lawn. I took up a position behind shrubbery, from which I could watch the driveway. I thought I knew how the cultists intended to get the job done. They wouldn't drive right up to the house, wouldn't want the engine noise to announce their arrival. Besides, they'd block the driveway with their vehicle, so that no visitor could get past it. One man to stay with the car. The others, four, five, whatever, would arrive on foot. Two for the front door, two or three for the back, to prevent Lauren and her daughters from fleeing that way. All of them with combat rifles. Kick in the front door. Maybe fire a burst into the ceiling to intimidate. Blue Sky Ranch was semi-isolated. Anyone who heard the gunfire at a distance wouldn't be able to pinpoint its origin. The invaders would move fast through the house, find Lauren and the girls, herd them to one room, gang-rape them within sight of one another. Humiliating them was an important element of the ritual sacrifice. Humiliate, terrify, demean, diminish, bring to despair. If this church had a community outreach program, it would be symbolized on their stationery not as an open hand, but as a fist. There might be black candles on whatever makeshift altar they used. Tannis root paste and a fungus called devil's pepper that those being sacrificed were forced to swallow. Most likely a quick ceremony. A couple of Hail Satans, a sip of blood. This was a busy night for the cult of Meridian. From the rapes, they would go directly to the ceremonial knife. None of the usual preliminary torture and disfigurement. Just the killing cut. Three times. A cold, controlled fury had gripped me, greater than any anger I had experienced before. I felt as if there were two odds in the same skin. The fry cook who had written poetry for the girl he loved and wept at movies like Terms of Endearment, but also the ruthless killer who could shoot men in the back. The darker odd Thomas thought his violence must be righteous, in the service of good, for the protection of the innocent. But the other odd wondered if the claim of righteous purpose, exerted so often in these past 2 years, was always true, or if it might be overused. There were nights when consideration of that issue would not allow sleep. In spite of all the doubt, my fury didn't abate. On my knees behind the shrubbery, monitoring the driveway, I didn't like what I smelled. The offender wasn't the foliage with its tiny white flowers, which provided a green leaf scent and a faint sweet fragrance similar to jasmine. The odor was mine. And it seemed to me that only part of it could be a consequence of all the sweating I'd done and the chemicals in the gray snowflake ashes that had dissolved and stuck to my hair and jacket. Maybe part of it was the malodor of a deeper corruption. If I progressed from being a righteous man to being a scourge, my destiny might not match Gypsy Mummy's prediction. Scourges assumed authority they had not been granted. They made a carefully reasoned decision to kill in greater numbers than were absolutely necessary to save themselves and the innocents who needed their protection. Scourges transgressed against social and sacred order. In Hamlet, the prince lacked the clarity of heart and the courage to be a minister of truth, as he should have been. But he sure was a bang-up scourge, inflicting upon his kingdom more killing than necessary. Scourges themselves are always scourged. The prince did not survive the play. Moses scourged 3,000 people and did not live to see the promised land. Crickets and toads had been singing in the nearby meadow that began where the mown lawn ended. They stopped abruptly, as if they had all forgotten their songs. 42. Since kneeling behind the shrubbery, I had avoided looking to the left, toward the Ainsworth house, or to the right, where flames from the gasoline fire unfurled like flags of hell. My eyes were somewhat dark-adapted once more. Out there in the night, where the driveway turned from east to south and proceeded toward the residence, dark figures appeared. The brightly lighted residence no doubt compelled them to remove their night-vision goggles. They were clustered together, difficult to count. Closely grouped, they made one target, tempting. But even if they remained in tight formation until they reached the front porch, I couldn't be sure of dropping them all. My weapon might not be set on burst fire. I wouldn't know until I squeezed the trigger. I was too far away to stand up and pick them off one by one. They would scatter, and I would have lost the advantage of surprise. Besides, I didn't have sniper skills. I was a close-up killer. I held my position until I was able to count them. Four. They ordered themselves into pairs as they came toward the house, which suggested that my idea of how they would do the job must be on the money. The line of shrubs, defining the end of the lawn, grew waist-high, with a 2-foot gap between each bush. I rose into a crouch and hurried toward the back of the house, not fully concealed. My powder-blue sport coat was definitely not the new black. I was better dressed for a prom than for secret ops. I counted on darkness, and the likelihood that they would be focused on the house